Hey, gang. Thank you for joining me for episode 13 of Convince Me. I have a guest that I have wanted to have on since I started, and I could not be more proud that we got to sit down and chat with him. And that guest is Jesse David Fox, senior editor of Vulture and host of Good One Podcast. Good One Podcast is awesome for any creative, but specifically for comics, because he pulls in comedians and they talk about one joke off an album or a special and really dissect it. And it's really a lot of fun and gives some good insight. And also, Vulture is kind of the leading expert on comedy right now. And even though Jesse might argue with that, and I think he did during this episode, but Vulture really is it's a really great resource. And so I was really thrilled to speak with him, and I really appreciate that he took the time. And we had a really good conversation. So just wanted to say thanks again for joining me on Convince Me. And if this is your first episode, go back and listen to some of the others. They're really, really good stuff. Anyway, here is Jesse. Hey guys, thanks for dropping in to Convince Me today. I've got a very cool guest, the senior editor of Vulture and the host of Good One, which is an awesome podcast, which we will talk about later, Jesse David Fox.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you for calling the podcast awesome.
It is awesome. It is one of my favorite podcasts. And I think, you know, beyond just comics that should listen to it, I think anybody who does anything creative could get some great insight from
that. That's the hope. Yeah, I say it's a podcast about artists, but I only talk about I only talk to comedians, so that's the thing I know most about. But
right.
And because comedians are good at talking, where if I was like talking to photographers, it'd be a little bit too abstract.
It is different talking to somebody who doesn't talk for a living.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think about it all the time. I always think about like, because I photography is the other art form I'm like really interested in, or like food. I'm like, I don't think they'd be able to do it, because like ultimately, like so many of the visual arts are like, they can maybe talk about it, but they just sort of like can't talk in finite terms of like what the inspirations of things were.
Right.
Where comedians, like, this is like, even if they're not good at analyzing themselves, they're like good at filling time.
Yes. Yeah. If nothing else, comedians are great at, like you said, filling time, just jabbering until you find something you can land on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, since we're talking about Good One, and I said we would talk about it later, this technically is later. What inspired you to go, you know what, I want to sit down and talk to comics and analyze one joke? Because, you know, some shows, they'll do like a whole album or a special, but it's unique to say, you know, let's zero in on one joke.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple answers I think about all the time. So there's sort of a couple answers, and partly it is, I felt like I was interested in the joke writing process, or the comedy writing process. The hard thing is, you ask someone their process and it's too abstract, and they'll just be like, you know, I write on stage, and then that's sort of the end of it. And it's like, literally every comedian writes on stage, and it means 9,000 different things. So it's like, when they're talking about a specific joke, then the hope was, as they go from the A to the B to the C of it, right? They experience something. That's like the joke. When I talk about the writing process, I start from the moment you thought of this. Why did you think of it? What were you doing? Okay, then what did you do once you had this feeling? How did you know it was comedy? Then you can kind of walk through it and talk about how your brain works, opposed to just sort of how you create, but literally like, how does your brain... And I found that to be a really revelatory way to understand a person, at least, and that's how it builds. It's like we start seeing, like, it's essentially like we see their brain at work, and then we can sort of figure out the sort of psychology around that brain that sort of also feeds into it. And the other thing is, you know, I would write about comedy, but I wouldn't write reviews of everything. I'd just write reviews of jokes often. And I think it's partly like, the nature of my attention is not that I'm not great at focusing on large scale things. I'm better at focusing on really specific moments. and like being really locked into those moments and then expanding out. So I think it's just sort of also nature of my brain chemistry.
That's fair. And well, for comics or anyone that does, trying to think, a written word or what have you, but let's say specifically comics, because
sure.
As you said, that's what I know too. Yeah. That's what I can zero in on. You know, like other artists can point to something they've done and be like, hey, look at this painting or look at this sculpture, and here's the process with which I took a lump of clay and turned it into this beautiful piece of work.
Yes.
Whereas it is more conceptual and abstract for a comedian to, I know you just reposted Nate Bargatze's Dead Horse, which is a brilliant piece of work.
Yes, yes.
But so that's what's on fresh on my sure, on my mind. But him saying, you know, I saw this horse laying down, and then we went for a hike on the mountain, and then on the way back, my friend saw this. And if I'm not going to ruin the joke, I want other people to listen to it.
Yes, yeah. It's one of the great jokes of our time.
It really is. It really, because it's, he's got so many little bits and pieces and punchlines and tags. Yeah. In there that listening to him, you'll miss them the first time even, mm-hmm. because there's so much going on.
You're just following the story.
Yeah.
Sorry, continue.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, the thing about, like, I often, especially when it's a story, I use the analogy of a sculpture a lot, because it's like a story, a comedian often won't know what the story, like, they'll know the beats of it, just like anyone would know a story. But, like, you sort of, like, don't know what's funny until you sort of do it. And then people are like, oh. So where if you ask a sculptor, how do you, like, sculpt the arm? They're like, well, I carve this and this and this and this mm-hmm. and this and an arm. Where, you know, a story comedian like a Fortune theme star, it's like, well, I did it this way, and then people really responded this way with that. The other thing is there are some decisions that are its own things. I wish I could think of a specific example, but it's like, a joke was this far along, and then, like, this happened, and then this became part of the joke. Like, and where, for the most part, artists, you know, it depends, but a lot of artists, they're doing it all at once, and then the thing is the thing that they did at the time that they did it. You know, the work is not showing all the steps along the way, because, like, they don't need to do it 1,000 times in front of people to have the thing be finished.
Yeah.
And that interaction, it allows it to be a really interesting way to, one, see how a person works, and also just sort of see how a person interacts with society.
Well, and it's, I forget where I read it, but, you know, stand-up is the only art form where you have to fail in front of people in order to get good at it.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think if there's any other. I always try to think of other art forms in which people have to do it in front of people.
Boxing, maybe.
Like, yeah, but you have to. You could box like just you too, right? It's like ultimately you don't need it. I guess you need a ref. Anything right. That needs refs.
Well, like I guess boxing, you're in the gym, and you're still in. I don't know. I don't know of any other. Like, what you would consider an art form.
Yeah.
Where you have to say, here's this half-formed piece of work that I'm still working on it, but here, take a look at it. What do you think? Well, that sucks.
It's so weird. It's a really weird thing. It's weird how many people do it. It's weird that it works. It's like, and it continues to work. There's generations of people who are able to do it and be unique and... I think, thankfully, audiences have evolved, so it's like, you know, the problem would be if, like, the audience of the 80s was the audience for the rest of history. So then, like, comedy would, like, have to deal with, like, whatever those expectations are.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, like, I think now we have this audience that, I don't know across the board, but we have a lot of people who know the fact that comedians work on material.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that they write material, that the things that they say happen to them, or the opposite, which is sometimes the things they say don't happen to. Like, that level of savvy allows for then comedy people moving forward. and thankful, because otherwise I don't think I would have a job because it'd be too boring.
Well, do you find that that's also the case with, you know, being that you are, you know, the senior editor at Vulture, do you, and you've been, when did you, 2012-ish?
Yeah. What year is it now? 2021? So.
It's funny. I just went to the doctor the other day and it was like, how old are you? And I had to text my wife and be like, I don't, how old am I? Because what year is it?
I'd have to imagine it's 2013. Because I can't imagine I've been there 9 years. In my head, I've been there 7.5 years. If I've been there 8.5 years, that's wild. People don't stick in jobs that long, especially media. So, but I've been there 7.5 years, let's say. So yeah, 2013, I think I started. The end of 2013.
Okay. And I know you've seen some changes since then. I mean, we were in the middle of a new comedy boom.
Yes. Well, I have complicated feelings about that.
Okay. Ooh.
Do you want me to get into it?
I do. Absolutely, I do.
Okay. I'm going to try to say this as succinctly as possible. I called it a comedy boom. I was the first person to do it in whatever year I wrote that, 2014, 2015. I said, welcome to the new comedy boom, welcome to the second comedy boom, referring to the 80s as the first comedy boom. Mm-hmm. Some argue there was a comedy boom of the sort of 50s and 60s, which was the comedy record boom. But it doesn't really matter, because I don't think booms exist. I think it's a fake idea, okay. I think. And I think, especially now, it's clear. I think what we think of as booms are like times in which the popularity of comedy is in such a discrete place that we can be like, this is booming, right? So it's like in the 80s, there are all these comedy clubs, and that's all of, when we define the comedy boom of the 80s, we're just talking about comedy clubs. We're not talking about the state of like comedy and television, which there were some shows, but it was not associated, or like comedy movies, which there were some, but it was not associated. Mm-hmm. But like, and the same thing with the 60s, it's just sort of like, when you say the comedy boom of the 60s, you mean records, but like the live business was nothing like what it was a decade later, right? You didn't have comedians as big as Steve Martin in the 60s.
Right.
But then, like, what do you call the 70s? When, like, Richard Pryor was in his prime, Bill Cosby was in his prime, George Carlin was in his prime, Steve Martin was playing to tens of thousands of people, Saturday Night Live premiere? Mm-hmm. You're like, and it's like, why is that not a boom? Like, why is that a different thing than what happened in the 80s? Like, I do think if you want to use the term boom, you can say the stand-up club boom of the 80s, but, like, I think of comedy as ultimately a increasingly popular, like sort of modern comedy is an increasingly popular art form, but ultimately it is a renewably interested thing that people are interested in. Each generation has their own thing. And it's it just takes different shapes. So like when there are new things, ultimately it seems like a boom. So like why we think we're in a comedy boom right now, or especially around 2015, is like, to me, comedy is a history of paradigms that are shaped around audiences. And so comedy changes, not by breakthrough comedians, in my opinion, but by the venues and platforms in which people can consume comedy. So there's like a lot of new comedy being made in the early 20th century because radio started and vaudeville really picked up and film was catching up. And then comedy adapted to those mediums because it's cheap to produce art form compared to drama and stuff. You don't need costumes in the same way. And that keeps on happening. Mm-hmm. Comedy is really big at the beginning of television. Then you have comedy clubs are invented, so comedy does well there. And then, so comedy clubs dips, but you see a rise of all these comedy sitcoms, Comedy Central premieres. So there's tons of ways of watching comedy. So to say that was the end of a boom is crazy because more people were watching comedy than during the 80s. So the reason why we think of the comedy boom that has been the last now 12 years mm-hmm. is because there were multiple platforms that were all created at the exact same time. You had Twitter, podcasts, YouTube, all essentially started at the exact same time. And then it keeps on happening. There's new platforms that are constantly being produced. So it keeps on renewing. So yes, it is a comedy boom, I guess, but I ultimately think it is a... This is just how it goes. It is it's a content boom, and comedy is one of our one of the main American forms of content.
That was beautiful. Thanks for listening, everybody. If I add anything else, it's just going to be a jackass spitting at a microphone.
I'm sorry. No. I'm working on a book, and it's the chapter of the book I'm working on. So.
Please don't apologize. That was beautiful. Why would?
Okay. Yeah.
I'm just not smart enough to follow up on that.
It's also unfair, because I put into the world that it's a boom, and then people will ask me about this thing that I said, and I'll be like, well, actually, that's not correct. It's like, but you said it. It's like, yeah, that was the thing that I was saying then.
But I acquired more data, and now I've changed my position.
It's like data, it's new perspective. Like, yeah. It's all, like, my opinion on it. I think it's just sort of...
well, but let's face it. Your opinion is considered kind of... I mean, you... Vulture is the premier resource for comedy right now.
Sure.
And so when Jesse David Fox says, here's this about comedy, people listen.
Yeah, I mean, as we'll get into when we talk about a topic, I sort of can't accept that, but I know what you mean. I think it's, if you're... tell the story of comedy, you when you do eras, it's much easier to understand it in terms of venues than it is by people, because there are overlapping things that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, when Lenny Bruce was popular, there were still like these sort of lounge nightclub-y acts, you know, like what's his name, the freaking mean guy who
Rickles.
Don Rickles yeah. has been around for all of these comedy movements.
Yeah.
Right? So he's a nightclub style comedian, right? He's like, but he was a popular nightclub style comedian when Lenny Bruce existed, when Nichols and May, when like people became hippies, he was still on Johnny Carson. Like, so you don't learn enough by comedy by just following one person's era. It's much easier, kind of like art movements, to be like, oh, this is when comedy was in nightclubs. And as a result, the style was like this. And this is when comedy was in coffee shops and folk music, and mm-hmm. the venues were like people who like jazz. So then people were like this, and then, you know, it's and that's the same thing. Like the '80s was all these comedy clubs, these sort of like manufactured comedy clubs all over the country with people who don't know that much about comedy, looking for just with the lowest expectation of what comedy should be. And as a result, people had to give them it. They'd be like, here are like, C-minus observations,
right,
about flying and airplane food. I wonder if this is a thing I don't know, like when like the history of air travel, and if the airplane food jokes really were popular because there's a time when like more people were flying but there was still food on planes. These are things that I will probably look into after this, but
well, and I wonder if it was, as it was becoming popular, and you still had a sect of people that found it to be, for lack
novel.
Of a better, as a bougie, yeah. It was a bougie yeah. thing, and people that, you know, were going to the comedy clubs were your salt of the earth type folk, and maybe making fun of something that they considered out of their reach.
Mm.
Felt like it was landing home with them, and so people were just doing it.
There's just also, like, the world had gone unobserved, and then these people started doing it. And, like, I think about Jerry Seinfeld a lot in general, but, like, I have this Patreon podcast called The Specials, and we did an episode about his I'm Telling You for the Last Time, which he was sort of doing, was like a kind of greatest hits of jokes. And he has these airplane jokes that sort of, like, invented the airplane jokes. Like, when we think of airplane jokes, it's people being like, oh, we can do this. It's partly because comedians travel so much. But just the joke of the pilot says, today we're going to do this, this, and that. And then the response of, like, yeah, all right, do whatever. Like, I'm going to be here. And then, like, that dynamic, that do you observe this world we're all living in and being able to offer something is... like, at the highest level, it's, you know, that's, like, what mastery is. But if there's something of, like, why did we just go, like, not observing our lives in the same way? But for the most part, it was, once you knew that was an option, I imagine people were like, oh, I'll go see comedy, and then I'm just going to point out a bunch of stuff that I related to. And then I'll be like, yeah, I get that. right? It's like, there's like a million different theories about why people laugh, and you know, they're contradictory. Some people are like, oh, you laugh because you're surprised, and then some people are like, no, you laugh because you agree.
Right.
Both theories exist at the same time. And I think like they're probably theories that came up at a time relating to when they came up with, but like, I feel like the idea that you laugh in agreement is like a 1980s idea of like, yeah, me too.
Yeah, my wife spends money too. Yeah.
Yeah. New York and LA are different. I'm acknowledging that comparison. And they are. And it's a valid premise. At least it's not like, you know, the false premises that would come on after. But like, you know, at least you're telling the truth. Like, it's not like your deep truth, but like, I guess you're being honest if you're like, you know, white people drive like this and black people drive like that.
Right. Well, and I know I'm probably not going to attribute it to the right person, so I'm not going to say who I think said this, somebody said somewhere, sometime on a podcast somewhere, that good stand-up comedy is like a good magic trick, because you know that, like, if somebody's doing a good three-card Monty, you know you're not going to win. You know you're going to follow that card, and they're still going to pull the queen up somewhere else. And I always thought that that was a really good analogy, because the idea of it's a surprise, but even then, sometimes it's not. You know, I've had people, while I'm telling a joke, like one or two where they're like, you can see them know where I'm going, which part of me as a stand-up, I'm like, well, I don't want you to know where I'm going. But then those always end up being the people that are laughing the hardest.
Yeah.
Because they're poking the person next to them because they've already related to it.
Yeah. When they say that's so true. People are like that.
Yeah.
People that have to, there's people that don't know that they talk when they laugh. Uh-huh. It's my favorite thing in the world. I had a friend who used to like say the funny thing back. It's the magic trick thing is interesting because it's like there are magic tricks where you are surprised, right? It's like, but ultimately he's like, I'm going to pull a rabbit out of this hat, and then he does, right? So then like it's not a surprise.
Yeah.
But it speaks to there are many theories about why people laugh, and there are problems with a lot of them. But the one that I like the best is it's called play theory. I don't know how familiar you are with joke type theories, but I don't have the book around. But the idea is essentially like we like comedy and laughter is descended from playing that like comes from apes and stuff. Because there'd be like comedy theories be like, well, we're the only species that laughs. It's like, well, that's not true.
No.
A lot of mammals laugh. But so like I think so a lot of comedy theories are essentially joke theories. They're like, you laugh because at first moments you think it's this and then this happens, right? And either that's a surprise or it's an incongruity or it's a release or it's this person's knocked down a peg, blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, comedy, even a joke, is a state. It is not a discrete moment. It's essentially like once the joke starts, you are in joke. Like a comedian's job is to create a sense of play. So like, it's why people laugh at not just the funny parts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's why you laugh when it's just comedians being themselves. And it's why you laugh more when you're around other people. Because, like, it's play and it's social. It's not just, like, it's why when you're at home in that context, you're not going to laugh as much. Because, like, ultimately, it's not as fun. Like, part of it is, like, being caught up in it. And that's the thing of the magic trick, right? If you allow yourself, it's, like, you know it's fake. But, like, allow yourself to feel wonder opposed to cynicism, like, mm-hmm. is going to be it's going to make you think the world is bigger than it is or whatever. It's, like, truly, like, it's idealism. It's, like, allowing yourself to have that when everything else in your life, like, is arguing that life sucks to have these things. Is, like, you know, Pete Holmes has a pretty famous joke about going to see magic that is, like, this essential idea of, like, why try to solve it, especially in the moment? Like, I understand, like, it's fun to, like, try to do the puzzle, but, like there's this recent magic special on Hulu by Derek Delguadio or something like that that's really freaky and, like, high-end and serious. And comedians are obsessed with it. Like, most people talking about it are comedians. And then so you watch it, and, like, everyone around is trying to figure out how it works. And I'm like, if we know how it works, that's not how it works. We're not magicians. If we knew how it worked, that's not it. People are like, oh, well, you probably, you know, there's this big thing, these big, there's this part, have you watched it?
No, it's okay. Actually, it's on the list, hopefully within the next couple of weeks, but yeah, I plan on.
There's two remarkable things. There's one, unreal thing, and then people are like, yeah, they probably called a person ahead. It's like, if that's how they did it, we'd all know, or we would have done it.
Yeah.
And then also Penn Jillette and his friend Teller went to see it and asked, you know, as they do, it's like, oh, is it one of these? And they're like, no. And then I guess the other one went and was like, we're going to on purpose try to trick him up. And if he doesn't get tricked up, that means we have no idea how he did it. And they have no idea how he did it. So that means, like, it's the same type of wonder, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's the wonder of this man is magic. Like, that's amazing. Like, we're regular people, and then there's a man who's magic. But there's also the wonder of, like, this person did an extraordinary thing as a human. It's like, it's still amazing. Like, if, I don't know, like, if a man invented a rope, like, if a man, like, invented superpowers, how do I want to put this? I think you're getting where the analogy is going. Either way, either, like, the prefabrication of it is amazing, or the fact that it is magic, it's, like, not that different of an amazement. You just have to, like, allow yourself one moment of not knowing how something is going. Like, it's essentially just control. Like, just allow yourself to give yourself over to the world and not be like you're the ruler of, like, what is happening, and as a result you're in charge. And I think that's the same thing with comedy audiences, right? There's, like, the people in the audience who are, like, defying you to make them laugh.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, well, I could be doing that too. I just am not.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The guy that comes in with his wife and her friends, and he doesn't want to be there, and he sits down and crosses his arms and puts his chin down and dares you, and that's the only... You can make the entire room laugh, but the only person you see is the sourpuss sitting next to his wife, and just like, yeah. What, who, and I know it's cliche, but who hurt you?
Yeah.
Who, what happened in your life? Are you used to being the center of attention? I'm so sorry. This is, for the next few minutes, just let me make you happy. Let's do that.
Yeah, I feel bad when I go to comedy shows. I don't do that. I sometimes fake laugh just so the comedian doesn't realize it, because, like, sometimes I'm not laughing because, like, I sort of, maybe I've seen them before because I just, like, see comedy more than most. Or, so I know kind of their thing. Or I'm just like, well, this is not that good. Or this isn't, like, I kind of know this thing. It's like, are we still doing that in this year? And I feel bad because other people around me are laughing because they don't have that exposure to this stuff. And I'm like, I don't want him to be like, call on me or whatever. One, I don't want that ever, but I dread the moment where someone's like, what do you do for a living? And I'm like, I'm a professional comedy discusser or whatever I would call myself. Because I think it'd be truly like a really hard thing for a comedian to respond to, because partly because I know me, like, there's in the modern era, the only time I've, like, raised, like, an audience, a comedian will ask a question, I answered it. I went to see Microbiglia's Thank God for Jokes when I was writing a story about Microbiglia. So I was seeing it for the second or third time at that point. And at a point, he was like, oh, has anyone been arrested, is the question he asked. And I was not planning on saying anything because, for the same reason. But I had, and no one was doing anything. So I was like, and then he didn't see it was me. And then I was like, oh no. And then it's like a whole story about the time I got arrested. And I'm like, and I usually tell in the context of, like, here's one of my two stories I have. And I was like, I don't have a shorter version of the story. I've never done it in dialogue. And I was like, this is bad. Like, I'm ruining this show.
Yeah, well, and that's the roll of the dice when you're doing crowd work to see, you know, is it going to work or not? I'm not a crowd work guy, if I can at all help it. I like going up with my plan, and if something organically happens, great. But I have never went, you know what? Because I'm not Mike Birbiglia. I know that about myself. I'm not. There's comics that can do that. I'm not one of them. I understand that about myself. I have my strengths. I know my weaknesses. And it's just, I stay in my wheelhouse, and I do my thing, and I'm happy. And everybody's happy, and that's the whole point. I don't know
I think with crowd work, I was talking to Moshe Kasher about it when he was on, and he's like, the thing is, there are people who are great at it, and it's the thing that they do, and then for the most part, most people's relationship to crowd work is a comedian trying to fill time because they know that they need to do 45 minutes and they only have 20 because they just filmed a special or whatever, or they always only have 20 because they're lazy. And and they know that crowd work is like a simple magic trick, right? It's like that it's improv where you already kind of know the other person's line.
The pulling the finger off with the thumb, yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's just sort of like, what do you do for a living? And then someone has a job, and it's either a job you have jokes about, like, I'm a teacher. It's like, oh, yeah, teachers, I had this teacher, and she sucked, or whatever. Or they have a weird job, and then the joke is like, that job's weird. And that's like, it all works. And he's like, oh, my God, he said it in the moment. but, like, I don't begrudge it. Like, you know, the comedian has a job to do. Like,
yeah.
I have the luxury of, like, when I think about comedy and, like, write about comedy or whatever, for the most part, it's, like, when it's done. It's like you talk about specials because, like, well, this is the finished product. You made a thing. Mm-hmm. I'm aware that in the night that a comedian is performing, you know, it can go any ways, and you have to do whatever you can to, like, make it feel like a show. I feel like criticizing that is, like, it's kind of like I think it's weird to criticize people's jobs, I guess, as a critic. Yeah, I mean, like, obviously you can criticize, like, a mayor if he's doing a bad job. But I mean, like, I don't know. It'd be weird to, like, publish an article critiquing a dentist, I guess, who's, like, kind of like an average dentist. But if they were, like, releasing a book on dentistry, then it's like, oh, this is, like, kind of a culmination of them. I don't know if I actually believe what I'm saying, but, like, I do think I'm on to something.
Yeah, I think we've got a good hypothesis, and we could get a good theory going here if we really put some elbow grease into it.
Yeah, I'm gonna think about it nonstop for like the next 3 years and get back to you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. We'll schedule you for a return. Okay, so like I told you before we even started, and like my listeners know, I'm terrible at transitions on this show. I really ought to figure out a way. Like, maybe there's should be a button I hit where I play some music, like the laughing round. I love the idea of that. I don't have that.
So this is what I'll say. So because the laughing round is actually a very awkward transition that we cut out, because we, for those who aren't familiar, there's a, you know, I do this interview that's like of a style. I think it's fairly, I don't know if it's intense, but it's like the guest has to really think about answers. You know, like it's just like pretty really interviewee interview. But then there's sort of an end part that's like lighter. They're lighter questions. Some of them are shorter, or they're just sort of easy stuff. And I call it the laughing round because it's like a lightning round, but it's comedy. Anyway, but there's a sound effect that happens. Now it's time for it, right? But because we do it over Zoom, especially now, we don't play the sound effect because you can't do that. But I have to tell the person a new thing's happening, but they're not going to hear the sound, but I'm going to say a sound happens. So in the middle of an interview, often after the most intense question, I have to be like, okay, so I'm about to say something. And this is the only reason and then I have to explain. And you know, listeners of the show like to joke that I explain the thing the same way every time, but I also explain my explanation of the thing the same way every time. We just cut that out.
Well, again, I'm glad I'm not alone in that, because I explain it every time. So
there's always new listeners.
Right. Well, and you know what? If I pick up a few new listeners, this may be the first episode they hear it. They've gotta do this. And if
you never know.
If you're a loyal listener, just hit the 30-second jump, and you'll get to the good stuff. But as we know on this show, we celebrate our differences every time. That's what we do, and we accept them, and we love them. And so we always start this part with Jesse. What is it that you hate is such a strong word. Mm-hmm. What is it you strongly dislike that other people seem to enjoy?
Yes. I'm going to have to explain it because I did give you a short answer when you asked ahead of time. And then I'm like, I don't know if this makes sense, but it's the idea.
This whole show is nonsense. It's okay. You don't have to.
It's the thing that I don't hate a lot of things, and especially not like specific like art or whatever, but I hate the sort of need to be correct. The feeling that people need to have, the idea that you have opinions, but the feeling that you need to have the correct opinion is a thing that I, I guess I do hate it. I do hate seeing it. I hate seeing when people do it. I am not natural to do it, but I do sort of like think that we culturally have like keep on going a direction where people can't stand if there is a group of people who do not agree with them, and not in like a political sense, which obviously they can't stand, but like I'm saying, like that sort of like it's like essentially the same thing, which is like what was once a thing that was left or political divide is now like used every single thing we have to like go 12 rounds on, and I hate it. I don't know why people can't just like have the thing that like, I also think it's interesting when people say why they like the thing, not why a thing is good.
Mm-hmm.
Like the idea of I like a thing because it's good is really, I think, an uninteresting point. And I don't like when people say that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. Cause I've had this conversation a lot, and what I've boiled it down to, and it's probably the smartest thing I've ever said in my life, is... please do, please. Buckle up. Grab your hat and hold on to it. People are more concerned about being right than what is actually right. And I think we desperately avoid politics on this show because, you know, most people, we're inundated with it, and it is, I understand that is a point of privilege. I don't avoid it in my everyday life, but on this show, yeah. But, you know, we've seen it for the past, not even, I'm not going to say 4 years, I'm going to say for as long as I started paying attention.
Yeah, I would say, recently interviewing Margaret Cho, and I asked her about George W. Bush, and she was like, after 9/11, that was like the big difference of how the discourse changed.
Mm-hmm.
And also like the internet was also kind of happening at the same time. But I do think like that style of how we can talk about politics, because of 9/11, because of also the rise of cable news and the rise of comedy news, has made everything this sort of like, there is like winners and losers type. It gets covered like sports, so as a result, we talk about it like sports.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we then have been like reverse engineered because we started treating politics like television. We now treat television like politics.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that's, we see people that, or do you have conversations with people where we'll circle it back to comedy, where somebody will be like, "Well, I love this guy," and you're like, "Well, he's not my cup of tea." But I understand why. Well, how do you not like him? Well, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not judging you for liking this. Which is, again, when you said this is what I wanted, this is my dislike, I'm like, no, this is perfect for this show. Because this is what we talk about. You know, it's not a judgment call.
No.
For the most part. You know, it's okay, well, I don't, You like Avatar? I don't like Avatar. Well, how can you not like Avatar? Well, because I didn't think it was very... I mean, certain aspects of it are... well, that's ridiculous. And then this tirade about Avatar, and it's like, well, this is literally a difference of opinion. It has no basis on your... how I feel about you as a person. You know?
The thing that's frustrating is because it prevents us from having a more interesting conversation, which is, someone goes, I like Avatar. And I was like, oh, I didn't like it. Why did you like Avatar? And then it's just like, tell me about you and what about you likes Avatar. I'm now learning more about you. But instead, people feel the need to be like, have to have like the idea that these things are opinions are facts, or that they have to make a stylistic opinion about why they like Avatar. As a result, you should be like, oh, you're correct. And it happens, and it's, you know, been slowly happening. And then somewhere along the way, it's like become completely like toxic sized or whatever. Like it's ruined Rotten Tomatoes. And it's like because of like, and it's specifically centered around like the DC Cinematic Universe. Like more so than anything else, is because some critics are like, these movies are bad. And then people are so upset with them for saying it's bad. And it's wild because it's like, why must you like a good thing? Like, why must a thing you like be good? Like, why? Why? Mm-hmm. Like, we all like things that aren't good. Or, like we understand the idea that we can like food that isn't, like, good, whatever that means. Like, we're not all eating whatever is, like, the most refined food. But, right. I think we're able to do that. I mean, I guess there are people who are, like they talk about, let's say they talk about. And there's some people who talk about and they understand that Taco Bell is not as good as Liberta Dan or whatever, a fancy restaurant in New York City. Like, they understand, like, quality or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. The ingredients are worse quality and less time and care is put into it. So maybe they understand that, but they like what it is. They understand that they have a relationship to it. There's those people. But there are also, I guess, people who are like, that fancy shit sucks. This is good. This is real. Which is like, and I don't know tons of those people, I thought, but I was in a conversation about, in a room with friends or coworkers who are my friends, and they were like, well, American chocolate is bad, is what they said. And they're sort of talking about Hershey's. And I was like, what are we talking about? What is bad? What is better? What makes European better? What? It's like, all we're talking about is like a certain sort of like associations to like, how much fat is in something, how much acid is in something, that is like completely cultural. And we, as sort of like urbanites, are more exposed to like certain sort of touchstones. But like, why is that opinion necessarily better when we're sort of talking about lower end things? And it's, and I thought we all agreed that like, oh, there's no such thing as like better, especially in terms of food. And then they were like, oh yeah, yeah, of course. But like, American bread is bad. I was like, what are you talking about? There's so many bakeries. It's like the average one. I don't know. Like, I was comparing white bread to like whatever the bread is at a French grocery store. Like, to my taste, sure, but like a lot of people like white bread.
Yeah.
And it's and I don't have any reason to say one person's opinion is better than the other person's. Like, and like to bring it back to comedy in like my entire life, the reason I can't accept being a critic is that I have value systems for what I think is good or better comedy or what is worse, but I have no reason to say my assertion is like a more valid opinion than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are people who like are hacks, right? Like, I think it's like pretty easy to be like, hacks are bad, right? Because they're hacks and like they're doing a thing that's not new. They're doing things that are deliberately old. However, if you don't know all this stuff, if you like, it's your first comedy show, the first comedy you've ever seen, and someone's doing like entry level observations or whatever, if you've never seen it before, you'll like it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. And maybe you're like the smartest man on earth or whatever. And so it's not like, oh, well, yeah, but this person doesn't know anything. It's like, well, they were busy. So the only TV they got to watch is this. Like, I personally, this is just a personal thing. I sort of I can't stop doing it. At this point, like, my brain is broken. I can't have an opinion and assert it. It's not my nature, and especially as having opinions become more associated with conflict, I've avoided it. But, like, I used to rank the best stand-up specials of the year for Vulture, and I used to, at first, I was like, well, there's an idea of good, and I'm going to do that. And then I was like, what if we, like, there's no such thing as, like, what good is in that way. So instead, I have to explain what the value system of the list is, and then everything is going to be based on the value system of that list. But even doing that, I'm like, the bias, like, why is my value system the one that's going to be held up as the list? When it's like, the value system of a guy who watches 100 specials a year. Mm-hmm. That's like no one's life. Like, most people watch 2. So, like, actually my opinion and my value system is not as relatable. Like,
yeah.
I remember, like, Ali Wong's special came out, and she had, like, this idea about, like, feminism is bad for women because of this or that. I was like, Natasha Leggero did a similar-ish idea a couple years ago. I guess, you know, and it wasn't like she stole it. I was just like, it's, but no one saw, like, not that many people saw Natasha Leggero's special. They didn't necessarily remember it. They didn't, like, and so they're like, this is so funny, because I do think it's an interesting idea. It's subversive, and she does a great job with it. And I'm like, my opinion on this special is actually sort of not useful to anybody. Because most people, like, are not looking for what my perspective on that, and I think it wasn't worth my time. And then so as a result, it's a lot easier for me when I see people, like, state opinions. I'm like, why are you saying... It happened recently where I tweeted... The Grammys were recently, and I tweeted how I like Evermore better than Folklore. I like Evermore than Folklore, but that's sort of just me. It is, like, a relation to my aesthetics. This is not to actually say it is better or for worse or any other reason other than sort of my personal take. And then a bunch of people are like, I agree, this is correct. People are saying I'm right. Or some people are like, you don't have to say it's your opinion, this is the correct opinion. And I'm like, that's not my thing. I don't believe in having such a thing.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, you're talking about what you relate to in opinions. Like, when I was a kid, and I loved comedy from the moment that I discovered what it was. I was probably 5, and my mom set me in front of KPLR out of St. Louis, in front of a Jerry Lewis movie, and said, sit here, keep yourself busy for a little bit.
Sure, yeah, of course.
And I was like, oh, and then watched Singing in the Rain with my grandma, with Donald O'Connor doing Make 'Em Laugh, I was like, yes, that's the thing. That's the thing. And as I got older, of course, you know, then you start seeing all the stand-up that was on TV at the time when I was a kid, and I loved Marc Maron because he was so different than the sport coat rolled up, and I know that's, again, talking cliches, but, you know, these guys that were coming out and, you know, here, let me tell you about my wife and how awful she is. And I was like, I never understood talking about how awful the people you love are. But here comes Maron and is just this angry, long-haired, bespectacled dude. And I was like, oh, you're angry and I like you because of that.
And he really hates your wife.
but you can tell me why.
Yeah. And his wife is real. It's not like the idea of a wife.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, the fact is, though, you know, opinions should be able to be changed, because I use the term data because I used to crunch statistics a long time ago. And so as you collect data, those opinions and those feelings can shift, and it's okay to. It doesn't make you wrong. It doesn't make you weak. It's kind of cool. I didn't like The Office until I say that.
Oh,
I didn't like. You know what? Yeah, we'll stick with that example. I didn't like The Office until I started, however long ago it was when I started dating my wife, and she was like, I love The Office. I want you to watch it with me. And I was like, I don't care about... And then as I watched it, the wedding episode when Michael came back, not going to lie, cried.
Yeah, I mean, I cry all the time. I cry, I'll probably cry thinking about it. But that's because you're able to see it through her eyes. That's like a perfect example of it. If she was like, it's good because it's good, like, mm-hmm. I like it because it's good, then you, that's not a useful thing. But like, watch it with me, see how I enjoy it. And like, she's not explaining it to you, but it's ultimately the same thing, where it's like,
yeah.
Oh, I can see this sort of relationship to these characters, and that is, you know, it's, I mean, I get it. There are critics and there's a value to it, but I do think,
if more critics would just say, hey, this is my opinion, and this is my point of view.
So here's the thing. Oh, this is the thing that's hard. Because it's like, there's a certain sort of understanding with critics that is lost. There's sort of a, there's, the internet is sort of like, really messed with media literacy, and partly because like, critics now are universally exposed, opposed to like, I just write for the third of St. Louis that reads my newspaper, right? So it's like, there, the implication previously to criticism, my colleague Catherine Van Arendonk, who we currently have reviewing specials, but is a TV critic, she explains it and has explained it to me, which is like, her job is that if she says she likes something, then the reader will know that it's the same person who liked the previous thing she liked, right? So they, you're supposed to have internal validity, which is like, you can follow the person along and be like, I like the same things they like. There's so many critics that you follow the ones you like because you agree with them. You're not supposed to imply universal validity. However, because the internet, everything implies universal validity because it's exposed that way. People, the idea like, hey, this is my opinion, is lost. That is tacitly implied in all criticism. You just don't include it because that's kind of, would be boring writing, right? You'd have to be like, and of course, you know, this is all my opinion, which is why I'm not a critic, because I'd have to start every review being like, just, you know, this is my opinion, it doesn't really matter, blah, blah, blah. So, and it's something that I realized, this sort of like, how trained we are to see everything as like a to-death argument that is like, not about opinions, but it's saying something is right. From, I wrote this article with the headline, How Funny Does Comedy Need to Be, or something, and it's about this idea of post-comedy that I made up. Which is a comedy that is using the structure of comedy, but not necessarily for the same goal of comedy, which is laughter, mm-hmm. presupposed goal. And it was an essay in like a classic sense of what I understand, which is like the idea of an essay was like, I'm going to try out this opinion and we're going to see what it's like to do. That's like my goal as a writer, which is like, follow along. Let's see what happens when we think about this thing. But instead, people could not read it as, I'm saying this is better. Two groups of people, there's three groups of people. One group of people liked it, thought it was an interesting article, including comedians I respect and think are very smart. Then there was a second group of people, which were like online right-wing, like Ben Shapiro. Ben Shapiro talked about it, and Ben Shapiro was like, they got this post-comedy now, and he's like reading it, and his example of post-comedy was people like Seth Meyers and like all these political comedians who, though he clearly never watches, he just assumes they're not being funny anymore, and that's bad. So and then there are a lot of comedians who felt I was arguing that comedy shouldn't be funny, and that all comedy should be Nanette. That was the premise of the piece, and I'm like, I literally have a podcast about jokes. Like, and no, there's no reason for them to know that. But like, at no point do I say any of this. I literally say in the piece, like, this is not saying what thing's better or not. I'm just like, this thing is kind of happening, isn't it? And there's a variety of reasons people have had that opinion. But I was like, oh, because this is existing on the internet, people assume it's an argument. And I'm never like really doing that. I'm essentially, I think, the thought experiment. And it's hard because, like, I don't know if people like being angry, but they sure feel like they're supposed to be.
Right.
And, like, in my book, I have a part, which I don't know if I'll keep it because it's weird, be like, the number one rule is, like, have fun. If you find yourself being mad at anything I'm saying, either skip ahead or like just stop being mad because it's like not that serious and it's sort of, and like I guess I'm like trying to elide. I don't care if you criticize. Well, I would not like it if you criticize it because I wouldn't feel good. But like I understand you're allowed to criticize it. But like I do want to make sure we understand we're on the same page of what we're doing. And I just feel like we're. I think it's I really don't know why these people care so much that if why a thing that they like needs to be critically lauded. I don't know why it's a thing. It's the same thing as award shows. Like I feel like, so there was like Gen X was like award shows don't matter and are stupid, right? And then millennials were like, like, we know they're stupid, but like we'll put some importance to it because it's something to do, and but we understand it, we're taking it with a grain of salt. Like we knew the Grammys were stupid, whatever, we knew the Oscars were biased. And then and now like certain millennials, certain Gen Z have decided to like really provide to have to remove the part where we're aware they're stupid. And I'm not even saying I kind of understand the argument for it, which is like these things have cultural importance. When you do this, people buy albums, it makes it part of a canon. As a result of the canon, people keep on buying it. Projects like this get made because of blah, blah, blah. But the problem is these institutions do not hold up to that level of rigor. Like the Grammys, it's like Charlie Brown in the football. Every single time, if we're going to be like, they're going to get it right this time, whatever right means, you're going to be disappointed every single year.
Yeah.
And I just feel bad. Like, because I don't have opinions that I believe are correct, like, I don't think it's wrong to like the Grammys if you, like, believe in them. Like, I just feel bad because it does feel like a recipe for heartbreak.
Yeah, we actually, you know, you're talking about you don't have to like things that are good. We have a show on the network called Guilty Pleasures.
Sure.
And just recently, we talked about the movie Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man, starring Don Johnson and Mickey Rourke. It is a horrible movie. But you know what? I love that movie. It's a perfect guilty pleasure. And that's the whole, you know, the whole point is, look, we know it's not good. You recognize it's not good, but is it fun? For some of us, absolutely. So
it's like, why prioritize one type of enjoyment over like some sort of like better?
Right. Look, if I want to have fun, I'm going to watch Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man. If I want to cry, I'm going to watch Homeward Bound. You know, this is, I know what Homeward Bound does to me. It's fun for a little bit, and then I cry. I know what that does. Okay,
See if I can find this one tweet that John Early did. It's like so specific, but I don't want to get it wrong. I can't find it. He maybe deleted it, or I made it up. Or he might have said it live. He's like, it's something like the idea of like enjoying it. Like, it was basically like the idea of like straight white guys need to be incorrect. Like having the right opinions is like, when you describe liking that thing and like ironically or not ironically, or like enjoying that, whatever. Like, it's like, I think, I don't know, like there's just people that are so removed from a culture that would understand camp, like this sort of like DC universe fan that I'm imagining, that I'm now afraid of is going to dox me or whatever. Like, is so, it like can only understand liking something as if it's like number one most important serious thing, and if not, then like it's like they have an idea of how society should be structured, which is like they're number one, and that's the order of the universe. And the things that they like should be number one and should be treated like that. Mm-hmm. And anything that's not that is like, they can't enjoy that any other way. Like, it's seemingly, they're getting so angry that like, someone was like, Batman versus Superman, like, might not be like fine cinema. It's like, it wasn't even trying to be.
No.
Enjoy for what it was. Or like, don't enjoy for what it was. Like I saw that movie in Thailand. I remember being like, this movie's stupid, but like, at least it's like over the top. Like, the worst is, like, when it's stupid and sort of boring, but, like, this, I mean, like, an A.S. Snyder cut, yada, 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 but It's again, if you want to do this, it's your life. I'm just saying, it seems like way more fun to just like chill out about it a bit.
Right, right. So, okay, we've talked about the hate, and I could go on and on, honestly, about this for a long time, but I want to know what does Jesse love that no one else seems to like? Because this, I feel at this point, now we've really led into it.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, so I was trying to think, because, like, it does seem like, and this is kind of maybe too thematically similar, but it does seem like everyone's mad at Saturday Night Live all the time. Does that count as one?
Yes. Yes.
Clearly, Saturday Night Live is very popular. So, but it does seem like Saturday Night Live is this institution that's been around forever. It's really, it's, you know, it's very well watched. But this thing happens where people don't like it. And, but they liked it once, maybe, uh-huh. Uh-huh. Or they'll like parts of it, but they don't like it. Like, they like view it as a show, and they're like, I don't like this show, it's bad, or I don't like, whatever. Like, they just universally are like, this is a show that makes bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, I don't think I view it correct. I view it in a way it makes it so I like watching SNL seemingly more than anyone else I know, except for people who freaking love SNL. Like, I'm not like an SNL super fan. I'm like an SNL regular fan,
mm-hmm.
but I do feel like I watch in a way where I enjoy it a lot, which is, and I think this is kind of like how I try to tell people, like, watch comedy in general. It's like, if you don't think something's funny, well, isn't it interesting that something not funny is on television, like, or that someone's going to like this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a, you know, and this is important because, like, I can't remember if it was an interview Seth Meyers and I talked about this, or not an interview, because Seth and I talked about SNL in a variety of capacities, and it's essentially, like, the show's designed specifically so no one should like a whole episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if they do their job correct, no one will like it from top to bottom, because their goal is to hit a variety of types of humor. It is not Key and Peele, where it's through the prism of Key and Peele or Chappelle's Show, which is like, you're going there because you like Chappelle's point of view, and you're going to get that. Or Amy Schumer, et cetera, et cetera. Those are discrete things with discrete writing staffs and discrete tradition. SNL is resetting, new cast, new writers, and there's going to be a political thing in the beginning. I don't like it, usually, because I'm not a huge political humor fan in general. I think because I'm online all the time, the jokes aren't as fresh to me. But if you're a political person who has no relationship to jokes because you have any type of job that keeps you off the internet, like most jobs, once a week you get to see this and you're like, oh, thank God, I feel better that someone's making fun of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But so then I don't like that. And then it's like, there's a monologue and opinions are different. I like when it's singing because it's like fun, but people like it when they do, people seemingly want people to be doing monologues, which is interesting because most people aren't comedians, but like it is interesting to see a person do stand-up that ever done stand-up. And then it's like, usually there's like a stupid sketch, mm-hmm. right? It's like really broad and it's made for kids, or like made for the kids and all of us. Most recently those sketches have been written by Mikey Day, this guy Streeter. Like, they're always that first slot of a live sketch because they have freaking machines at that. And it's like, cool, let's see if I could tap into sort of the dumb part of me who likes fart jokes or whatever. And sometimes I can, sometimes I'm like, yeah, this is too much.
Yeah.
And then, like, it, you know, it goes different things, and that's fascinating. It's weird to watch a television show that has all those different stuff, and you know I wrote a piece about you should watch it like sports, where you're not watching it to be like, everything has to be a home run or whatever your favorite, like, dunks, and you only like dunks. You watch it be like, they're going to do something, and it's going to happen, and it doesn't work, and fine. And I don't, and to me, it's like the way to enjoy it the most. Mm-hmm. Like, you just follow it. You're like, it's this crazy world. It's so weird that they do this show. The cast is 9 million people. You know, like, it's funny because, again, it's so popular, so it's weird to be like, you got to hear about this show, SNL. But like,
have you heard about SNL?
It just seemed like people spend so much time being angry at it. And like, and not just angry at it for like, if you believe like it's had political negative blah blah, that's a different conversation.
Right.
But like, seemingly be angry just because they have sketches that you think are stupid.
Well, what I love are the people that are like, well, it used to be funny. And it's
God.
Okay, please tell me how Bass-O-Matic was a classic sketch.
Well, it makes, like, one, if you watch old sketches, they do not adhere to the contemporary standards of what a sketch. They're like 9 minutes long.
Yeah.
And they just sort of like amble along. And but people are saying it wasn't as good as it used to be since the second season when Chevy left, right? They're like, eh, it's not as good. This new guy's not as good. So they've been saying it over and over again. It is amazing to me that a person, a real person, would find a place to comment on a thing or tweet, show's not as good as when it, 10 years ago when it was this person, or 20 years ago when it was this person. When at that moment, everyone was, no one, there's never been a moment, except for the first season, where people are like, now the show, like the collective opinion was, now the show is good. Like, there were the collective opinion. Obviously, like, what the truth is at all times, there is a group of young people who are so excited that there's comedy on television that's talking, like, and that they're allowed to watch it. And those people love it. And then adults have, their taste becomes more specific, and as a result, the show doesn't appeal to them. But, like, yeah, you watch things from the beginning. You should not like a sketch from 1979 as much as you like a sketch from now. That's weird.
Yeah.
Like, especially as a young person, because, like, the writers are, like, currently ages probably, like, 25 to 45. So, like, if you're in that demo, this should be the time to watch the show.
Right.
And, like, I have personal taste opinions of, like, when is my favorite time, which was, like, when Seth was the head writer and Forte was there and Kristen Wiig and Andy Samberg. Like, mm-hmm. That's my personal taste. And I have to accept that, like, right now the show appeals to not me anymore as much as it does younger people. But so it goes. That's, you get older and SNL's not for you anymore. Look at the musical guests.
Right.
I don't know these people.
Easy pop pop.
Well, I don't know some, but I'm like, alright.
Well, I think SNL is actually a really good analogy for the shift in comedy and the shift in comedic taste, where, you know, we've seen it change the show, and as it changes with the writers and as it changes with the performers, who are half the time also the writers, you know, we get to see a shift in again, comedic taste and comedic sensibilities, which I think is actually, it's a really cool way to track it throughout, at least since 1970-something until now.
Yeah, especially since, like, the late 90s when the, because Jim Downey was, like, the head writer for, like, 12 years in the middle of it. And so, like, hypothetically, you'd say, like, oh, that's kind of... But, like, especially since, like, when Adam McKay was the head writer on, so it's, like, Adam McKay and Tina Fey, then it's, like, and we know the names of people, right? It's, like, ever since, like, Adam McKay's super famous now, and Tina Fey's super famous, and Seth Meyers super famous, and Colin Jost is super famous. And, like, there's the other head writer people that, like, who... You know, like, Brian Tucker is not as famous as Colin Jost and Michael Che are and Tina Fey are, but, like, you know, like, if anything, the show keeps on, the thing that is so amazing is that the show keeps on, it's not right all the time. Like, it is never, especially as there's more comedic talent, there's a lot of swings and misses. It is all based on, like, ultimately of who Lorne thinks will work. And if you get an audition, it probably means you're, like, on the path of something, but, like, he misses things and it's fine. But, like, he gets things right, and it's, like, you know, there are people in the cast now that I'm, like, oh, it's so cool, like, these people are going to be such a big deal. Like, they're already kind of a big deal. Like Bowen already feels like kind of a big deal, and he's only been in the show for 2 years. And it's, like, that's, like, every time there's these new casts, and I'm, like, I don't get them. And then next thing you know, they're, like, Bill Hader. And they're freaking everything. Or Kristen Wiig, like, there's some people who fright out the gate. But, like, Kristen Wiig, which is, like, a person on the show. She wasn't Amy Poehler. She was there. And then you're like, oh, Kristen Wiig is like one of the three great sketch performers that ever lived or whatever. And especially you see it now where it's like, all these people have these long careers now. Like, basically since 2000, everyone's working. Like, yeah. You get people with, like, Chris Parnell careers who are, like, they show up in something and have Tim Meadows shows up in something. You know he's going to be in a couple scenes and they're going to freaking rule.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. It's like that Tim Robinson sketch show, I Think You Should Leave, came out.
Oh, yes.
And I love it so much. But everyone's like, see, this is proof SNL sucks or something. It's like, how's it proof SNL? He worked on this show.
Yeah. He was there, and now he does this.
That's what we know him. You know.
I know. I'm taking a hard left, but you brought up Tim Robinson, Detroiters. Oh my God.
Oh, yeah, my favorite show. But that's for me.
Right. I love that show, and so when Comedy Central was like, "We're not going to do it anymore," I was just there was a period of mourning in our home. Where we were just like, let's not look at each other or talk to each other, or we just need to give it some time.
I wish it showed up on streaming, because I do think people would really enjoy to have that experience. It's just like, you know, I at the time I wrote a piece, because there's that show Corporate, and I was just like, some people like lighter things, like they're the, you know, and it's like, and some people like darker things, mm-hmm. Detroiters was like four people who like ultimately want their comedy to be on the light side, not light as in weightless, but sort of just like sillier and more childlike, and like that is like there, that's like where they find a sense of play or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like it. Like, that show was so silly and joyous, and but not substanceless, because like they never, like, it was always set in Detroit, and that was not like, obviously it's set in Detroit because that's where they're from, but there's like a groundedness that the Detroit brought to it. Of like, these are people who are like having fun and being silly in spite of certain sort of hardships that come with Detroit in the modern era. And they didn't say it outright, but like, that's like what was being conveyed. And like, I Think You Should Leave, I like a lot, but mm-hmm. Detroiters was like the thing that I missed the most and liked the most. And like, I don't know what it was. I think I either missed episodes and realized or forgot it, but like, I found like an episode I hadn't seen for some reason sometime beginning of the pandemic, and I was like, I think this just saved my life. Like, I think the fact that like there's the potential of the fact that I might have accidentally missed a Detroiters,
yeah,
and what that is as a metaphor for trying to make it through the pandemic, I was like, this is going to sustain me. Like, I'm going to ask hypothetically. It's
Well, Jesse, I want to thank you for being on the show. I hate to end the conversation because I feel like there's a lot that we started. And I'll be honest, I had some questions that I wanted to bring up.
Sorry.
No, don't apologize. This was fantastic, but I'd love to have you back on sometime.
Are there any quick factual questions you want to ask?
God, no. They're all conceptual. And
you asked me, like, how did you start the podcast? And then that's been the entire show.
And you know what? And it's been a fantastic show. Okay. But I really appreciate having you on. Please tell everybody about your podcasts and where to find you, and also, you know, tell them to read Vulture. But go ahead.
Sure, read Vulture. It's called Vulture.com. It's the best in the biz in terms of covering culture. I think ever, but I don't know. But I think it rules. It's the best. I love it. It's my home. Anyway, so I have a podcast. It's called Good One, a podcast about jokes. We have comedians on to play a clip of one of their jokes. It's not just stand-ups. It could be film directors. I had Jason Wollner talking about Borat. It could be Judd Apatow has been on, but a lot of it is stand-up or sketch. I had A.D. Bryant, Cecily Strong on. And we play a clip, and then we sort of talk about how they did it and sort of why they did it and who they are as it relates to it. You know, like, as you said, it's really an interview. Like, that's the thing that I pride myself on. It is not a hangout or not hanging out. I'm trying really hard. I put a lot of work into these questions. I demand the guest really be focused in answering it. And I think...
So the exact opposite of my show.
Yeah, and a lot of shows. And I think there's tons of places to hear that. I just sort of, like, really wanted to to do a thing that I'm really passionate about, which is sort of the form of interview mm-hmm. and using interview as storytelling. And, like, again, I think it works regardless of your interest in comedy. I think it's really about understanding people and gaining empathy for comedy you might not necessarily enjoy, but being like, oh, I kind of get it more now. I like it more now. And if you already liked it, you're like, oh, I really like it more now because this person's so interesting and complicated. I have a Patreon podcast that's sort of a spinoff. It's called The Specials. We watch a special, and then we talk about if it's good or bad. I try my best to try to have an opinion. We talk about specials we like a lot. We like Jerry Seinfeld's I'm Telling You for the Last Time. We talk about specials we really dislike, like Dennis Miller's All In, which is a special from 2005, which I really think universally, depending on no matter what your political opinion, you'd be like, this special is crap. And it's really fun. And I think we have a type of serious conversation about stand-up that I always wanted to have that you don't get to see a lot because, mm-hmm. you know, comedians are afraid of being pretentious, where I am not afraid of being pretentious. Social media, at Jesse David Fox. I'm writing a book. It will come out some point in the next few years. Check out... keep on checking in, and hopefully I will have done it. And I think that's it.
Awesome. And, well, you know what? We'll have you on before then, I would hope. But
Yeah. Once I'm promoting that book, I'm freaking going to go everywhere.
Just every place. Just we'll put you on every podcast we can. But
I appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. I really appreciate you sitting down and talking with us. This was a blast. And
I hope this worked. This was an episode of the show.
This is beautiful. It's a beautiful show. And thanks for joining us here.
When will this come out?
This will come out the beginning of April.
Well, I'm writing a piece about how April Fool's Day needs to transfer from being a prank-centered holiday to being a comedy-centered holiday. Like Halloween has become sort of a scariness-centered holiday. So I don't think it's really going to catch on. It's mostly a stupid thing that I wrote. But I do... Vulture will publish it on and then keep on publishing it around April. If that counts, hopefully I'll start a trend.
All right. Jesse, thank you again.
Thank you again.
It's great talking with you. Thank you so much.
All right. Have a great night.
You too.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.